Today, with biographies of great Rabbanim, today we will do short biographies of a lot of Rabbanim all the way from the year 3728, that's 32 BCE. We are using the text called The Jewish Experience 2000 Years by Rabbi Nachman Zakon, and we will be reading and learning from this sefer a different great Rabbanim. We'll start off with Hillel. Hillel was appointed Nasi. Hillel, a descendant of Dovin HaMelech, traveled there to Israel to study with the great scholars, Shmaya and Naphtalim. He was coming from Babel, where great Jewish communities and yeshivas had been established by the exiles after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. One cold winter day, Hillel did not have the money to pay the admission fee to attend the shiur being given by these great teachers. In his strong desire to learn Torah, he climbed to the roof of the lecture hall and lay down on the skylight, his ears pressed to it to hear his teacher's words. Hillel was so engrossed in the lecture, he did not notice the snow beginning to fall. As the snow piled up, he continued listening attentively. He was found the next morning buried under the snow, unconscious. Hillel's appointment as Nasi came about many years later when he came to the Beis HaMikdash for Pesach. That year, Erev Pesach was on the Shabbos, an unusual occurrence. Only Hillel knew the answers to the questions that were puzzling the Jewish leaders as to what to do in this rarely occurring situation. Seeing Hillel's vast knowledge, the leaders of Jewry at that time, known as the B'nai B'Seira, stepped down, telling Hillel that because of his greater wisdom he should take their place. Hillel is one of the great scholars called Tanoim. The Tanoim are the Rabbonim, the rabbis whose teachings are recorded in the Mishnah. Many people came to study Torah in Hillel's yeshiva. His students were known collectively as Beis Hillel, the Academy of Hillel, and alongside Hillel's yeshiva was Beis Shammai, the Academy of Shammai. Like Hillel, Shammai was one of the most outstanding students of Shemaiah and Naphtalim. He and Hillel were the two great leaders in their time. His students were known as Beis Shammai. The Mishnah lists hundreds of cases in which Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel disagreed over points of Jewish law. Now, interesting to note, though there are hundreds of instances in which the disciples of Shammai and Hillel had different opinions, their Rabbeim, Shammai and Hillel disagreed in only three cases. And by the way, in modern day Bnei Brak, Israel, there are two streets, one named for Beis Shammai and the other one named for Beis Hillel. Now we're going to talk about Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai in the year 3827 from the creation of the world, also known as 67 CE. So we find the Romans around Yerushalayim, the Jewish revolutionary armies could not withstand the overwhelming numbers of Roman legionaries. Though the Jewish soldiers defended themselves bravely, Vatnsen and his army were able to destroy city after city. Finally, he arrived at Yerushalayim and placed it under siege. No food or supplies could get in or out. The Jews were trapped, but the city had enough stores of food, grain, and other essentials to withstand a long siege. Unfortunately, unity among the trapped Jews was sorely lacking. Differences of opinion among the Jews about how to proceed with the war against the Romans erupted into bitter battles and even bloodshed. The storage centers of food, so vital to the city's ability to withstand a Roman siege, were burnt to the ground by Jewish zealots, hoping that the lack of food would force the Jews to leave the city and fight the Roman attackers. With the food gone and Yerushalayim sealed off by the Romans, the citizens of Yerushalayim suffered extreme hunger and thirst. People died in the streets from hunger. The situation was desperate, the destruction of Yerushalayim imminent. By the way, the Gemara brings down all of this as well. The rabbinical leader of Yerushalayim was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, recognized that it was crucial to Jewish survival that he meet with Vatnsen. He pretended to be dead and escaped the city in a casket. Once outside the city walls, he met with Vathbisson. When Rabbi Yochanan saw the general, he addressed him by the title Caesar. Moments later, Vathbisson received a message from Rome confirming Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's statement. The Senate had appointed Vathbisson as the new Caesar. In gratitude, Vathbisson told Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that he would grant him any request. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made three requests that would ensure the survival of the Jewish people long past the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of Rome. His first request was to spare the city of Yavne and its Torah scholars in the coming years. Yavne became a primary center for the continuation of Judaism and Jewish studies. His second request was that Rome not kill the descendants of Rabbi Gamliel, who was a descendant of Hillel and thus of the Davidic dynasty. This ensured that Jewish leadership would continue. Third, he asked that Vathbisson provide a medical team that would heal the righteous of Tzaddik, who had prayed and fasted for 40 years that the Beis HaMikdash should not be destroyed. His inspiration would be needed in the difficult times ahead. And by the way, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai is buried right near the Rambam's grave, which is in Tveria. Now we're going to talk about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was in the year 3894, or in the period of 134, according to the non-Jewish calendar. So Rabbi Akiva openly defied the Roman laws against teaching Torah. He reasoned that just as a fish out of water dies, so the Jewish nation without Torah study would perish. For this crime, the Romans imprisoned the great sage, who was 120 years old at the time, and sentenced him to death by torture. As the Romans tore the flesh off his body with iron combs, Rabbi Akiva started reciting the prayer Shema Yisrael with great joy, despite the terrible pain. His students asked him how he could do this. He told them that all of his life he wanted to fulfill the command to love Hashem, even if it meant dying for his sake. And now he had been given this great opportunity. With the final word of Shema, Hashem is one, Rabbi Akiva died of his wounds. The story of his heroic death has echoed down through the centuries as an example of Jews dying a martyr's death, al kiddush Hashem, to sanctify Hashem's name. And by the way, Rabbi Akiva was one of the 10 great Jewish leaders who were cruelly tortured and killed by the Romans. These 10 martyrs were called the Asori Harugi Malchus, which means the 10 killed by the government. The Jews remember them every year in special prayers said on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av. Now, just to give you an idea who Rabbi Akiva was, the graves of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Moshe Chaim Zatzal are right next to each other in Tveria. Akiva, the son of Yosef, an unlearned shepherd whose father had converted to Judaism, worked for a wealthy man, Kalba Savua. Kalba Savua's daughter Rochel saw the shepherd's outstanding character traits and recognized his great potential. She offered to marry him if he would commit himself exclusively to learning Torah. Akiva was undecided. After all, he didn't even know the Aleph Beis. He couldn't even read. While pondering his future, he noticed water dripping on a rock. The drops of water had eaten away the hard stone. This caught Rabbi Akiva's imagination, and he said to himself, if water can make an impression on hard stone, the Torah will have the power to impress itself on my uneducated mind. Thus, one of the greatest sages in Jewish history started his schooling at the age of 40 years old. Rachel's father was opposed to his daughter's choice of this husband. He told her that if she insisted upon marrying the shepherd Akiva, he would not give her any money to help support them. As the daughter of a wealthy man, she was used to a very high standard of living. Nice clothes, plenty of food, a beautiful house. She turned her back on all these things in order to marry Akiva. Many years later, Rabbi Akiva told his thousands of students, my Torah and your Torah belong to her. At the very beginning, Rabbi Akiva studied the Aleph Beis with the youngest children. 24 years later, he had become a prominent Rebbe and teacher and leader with over 24,000 students of his own. He survived the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash and lived on to become one of the key personalities who rebuilt the Jewish community after the Beis Hamikdash had been destroyed. One of the powerful ideas Rabbi Akiva stressed is the mitzvah v'ahavta re'echa kamocha, love your fellow Jew as you love yourself. Now we come to the year of 3960 from the creation of the world, and we're going to talk about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was born on the same day that Rabbi Akiva was murdered by the Romans. His father, Rav Shimon ben Gamliel II, defied the Roman laws against practicing Judaism and circumcised his firstborn son, naming him Yehuda. About the same time a baby was born to a Roman family, he grew up to be the emperor of Rome, Marcus Aurelius. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, leader of the Jews in his time, and Marcus Aurelius, known in the Talmud as Antionus, had a strong bond of friendship that lasted throughout their lifetimes and benefited the Jews greatly. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a very wealthy man whose fortunes rivaled those of some of the kings of his day. Though his riches would have enabled him to enjoy amazing luxuries, he never indulged himself. Instead, he used his great wealth to help others. Rabbi Yehuda is rarely called by his name or by his official title, Nasi Prince. Instead, he has been titled by the Jewish people Rabbeinu HaKadosh, our holy teacher, or simply Rebbe, for his role as the Jewish leader who had the oral Torah written down. In effect, Rebbe became the teacher of the oral Torah to all future generations. Now, the written Torah, the five books of Moshe, given at Sinai, was accompanied by an oral Torah, which explained the mitzvahs and added further laws. For centuries, this oral Torah was passed down from generation to generation, father to son, Rebbe to student. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi sensed that due to the upheavals of exile and the Roman persecution, some of the oral Torah would have to be written down or it would be forgotten. He called together the greatest rabbis of the time, and they gathered the teachings of the Tanoim, the sages who lived during and just after the second Beis Hamikdash period. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi composed the Mishnah based on that compilation of teachings. The Mishnah is a compendium of teachings on and disputes about Jewish law and covers topics as varied as the Shabbos and Yom Tovim, the Jewish holidays, the temple service, charities, civil matters, our culture, the laws of ritual purity, marriage, divorce laws. The Mishnah is composed of six sections called Siddurim. Each section deals with a different set of laws. These Siddurim are subdivided into 73 individual books called Masechtos, tractates. The Masechtos are further divided into chapters called Perakim, and finally into paragraphs called Mishnais. There are approximately 3,000 Mishnais in the entire Mishnah. Now the six Siddurim of the Mishnah are Seder Zeroyim, the laws of agriculture; Seder Moed, the laws of Jewish holidays and the Shabbos; Seder Nashim, the laws pertaining to relationships between men and women; Seder Nezikin, laws of damages, courts, and property; Seder Kachim, the laws of the Beis Hamikdash and the Karbanis and sacrifices; Seder Taharis, the laws of ritual purity and impurity. Now we're in the year approximately 4,235 or 475. Now we're going to talk about some of the Amoraim. There are many great men whose teachings appear in the Talmud, and they are called Amoraim. The Amoraim are great scholars, knowledgeable in all areas of Torah wisdom. They were also people of outstanding ethical and moral character. Now we're going to learn about some of these Amoraim. Rav and Shmuel. Rav never walked more than a few steps without being involved in Torah study and wearing his tzitzis and tefillin. Though he was the much respected founder of the yeshiva of Sur and Bavel, he remained humble. Rav considered learning Torah so important that he regarded its public study above the bringing of the daily sacrifices in the Beis Hamikdash. Rav's real name was Abba. The name Rav was given to him as a sign of respect. Rav is very often mentioned in the Talmud disagreeing with his colleague Shmuel, who headed the yeshiva of Nardiya in Bavel. The Talmud establishes guidelines for when there is a disagreement between these two great Torah scholars. When they argue about matters of ritual, the halacha, the law follows the opinion of Rav. If they argue about a civil matter, the law is decided according to Shmuel's opinion. Shmuel taught the rule that it is forbidden to mislead someone, Jew or non-Jew. Now we're going to talk about Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. When his father passed away, Rabbi Yochanan inherited large vineyards in the north of Eretz Israel. However, working in the vineyards would have distracted him from his Torah studies, so he sold them. This illustrates his devotion to Torah learning. Rabbi Yochanan is considered the compiler of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yochanan's greatest student was Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish had, as a very young man, left his Jewish studies to become a bandit. Rabbi Yochanan recognized the enormous potential in this young man and convinced him to return to his studies. Rabbi Yochanan was proved right when the former bandit became a challenging and diligent student. On every halacha, every law that Rabbi Yochanan taught, Reish Lakish would ask 24 different questions. He would review his studies 40 times. Reish Lakish's diligence and success made him one of the most respected Amoraim of the age, known for his unusual sharpness of mind. He married Rabbi Yochanan's sister, becoming the brother-in-law of the man who changed his life. In the many places where the Gemara, the Talmud, records the disputes between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in Jewish law, the halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan with only three exceptions. Then we have Abaya and Rav. The yeshiva in Pumbedisa, which had been started by the Amora Rabbi Yehuda and had become the primary Babylonian yeshiva, was looking for a new Rosh Yeshiva to replace the one that had passed away. There were four eligible candidates who met the rigid requirements in Torah knowledge, wisdom, and character traits for this prestigious and influential position. The four were Abaya, Rava, Rav Zera, and Rava Bar Masna. Abaya was chosen. His breadth of Torah wisdom was acquired despite his being orphaned at birth and growing up impoverished and weak. One of Abaya's great Talmudic sayings is that a person should always be willing to participate in community activities. Abaya also taught that in every generation there are 36 tzaddikim who merit to perceive the divine presence, the Shekhinah. Rav established yeshiva in the Chozem. Upon the passing of Abaya, Rav was appointed Rosh Yeshiva Pumbedisa, and he then moved yeshiva to Mecholza. Throughout the Talmud's pages, one can find Abaya's statements being challenged by Rav. In all the arguments between them, the Talmud teaches us that the law follows Rav's opinion, except for six times when the law is in accordance with Abaya. In fact, whenever any Amora disagrees with Rav, the law follows Rav. Once, to test the powers of the Rabbanim, the king demanded that Rav make it rain in the summer, a season when it never rains in Bavel. Rav prayed, and rain it did. Rav taught that Hashem created the evil inclination, but he created the Torah as its antidote. He also said that someone who embarrasses another person publicly has no share in the world to come. Hillel II, the Jewish calendar is based on lunar months, and the basic year has 354 days. In order to ensure that the Yom Tovim, the Jewish holidays, occur in their proper seasons, a complex system based on the 19-year cycle is employed. Leap years, which occur seven times in each 19-year cycle, have 13 months. In addition, the calendar is designed so that certain holidays do not fall on specific days of the week. Like, for example, the first day of Rosh Hashanah can never occur on a Sunday, Wednesday, or a Friday. Now, until 359 CE, or the year 4119 from the date of creation, the court in Israel determined when the months began, based on witnesses citing the new moon, and went to intercalculate a leap year. In the year 4119, when it became apparent that the courts would no longer be able to meet in Eretz Israel, Hillel II used the traditional formulas and calculations to create a Jewish calendar for every year. No other calendar of the ancient world has so accurately kept time to the present. Now we're going to talk about the period of the Gaonim, which was around 4,349, or in the year 589 CE. We're going to talk about three great Gaonim. The first one was Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia lived in the beginning of the 10th century, born in Mitzrayim. He was the first non-Babylonian to be chosen as a Gaon. Through his writings and position, he successfully fought the Karaites, apostate Jews who believed only in the written Torah and not in the oral Torah, as recorded in the Gemara. He translated the Torah into Arabic and wrote a commentary in Arabic on many of its books. Though his efforts, many Karaites returned to practicing Judaism. A prolific writer, his most famous work, Emunos Vedeos, is the first sefer written on the Torah Weltanschauung to be arranged by topics. It was vital in helping Jews in his time to resist assimilation. Then we have Rabbi Shiera and Rabbi Chai. Rabbi Shiera and his son Rabbi Chai were the last of the Gaonim. Father and son each lived for almost 100 years. Rav Shera was born in 900 and spanned the entire 10th century. Rabbi Chai died in the year 1038 at the age of 99. Their leadership was the last great flash of light before Babel ceased to be the Torah center of the Jewish world. Rabbi Shera and Rabbi Chai were brilliant scholars whose students and teachings passed the tradition on to the newly developing Torah centers in Europe. Rabbi Shera Gaon wrote Igeres Rabbeinu Shaira Gaon, an essay tracing Jewish history from the era of Moshe Rabbeinu to his own time. Rabbi Chai's greatness earned him the honor of being called the Father of Israel. Students came from all over the civilized world, including Italy, Spain, and Egypt, and there's Israel, to study under this great Gaon in Yeshiva of Pumpadisa. And we're going to talk about now Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. We go now to the year 4500. In what is today known as southern Russia, there once lived a tribe of fierce pagan warriors. Their king, Bulan II, called together representatives of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism to prove to him which was the true religion. His discussions with them convinced him to become a Jew. The Khazar king and about 4,000 of his people converted to Judaism. The Khazars, as they were known, ruled an area stretching over vast territory from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea for the next 300 years. Generations later, Rabbi Yehuda Levi used this episode as the basis of his classic work of Jewish philosophy called the Khuzari. It has been translated in English if anybody would like it. It is written in the form of a discussion between the king of the Khazars and his Jewish mentor. Rabbi Yehuda Levi was born in Toledo, Spain, and was one of the great Hebrew-Spanish poets whose poetry became part of the prayers of the Jewish people. His most famous composition was Sion Halosh Shishelo, which is recited on Tisha B'Av as part of the Kinos. In his dirge, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi expresses the yearning of the Jewish people to return to Eretz Yisrael. He also wrote the Shabbos song called Yom Shabbosim. Many people sing it on Shabbos at the meal. Now we go on to the year 4760, and we're going to talk about Rabbi Amnon. When Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna in his classic Or Zeruah relates that when the Sanu talk of a special prayer that said and the high holidays was written as a result of a tragic encounter between the Bishop of Mainz in Germany and Rabbi Amnon, the leader of the Jews in his generation. The Bishop and Rabbi Amnon would often discuss religious philosophy. Time and time again, the Bishop tried without success to convince the Rabbi to convert to Christianity. At the conclusion of one of their meetings, the bishop demanded Rabbi Amnon convert. Rabbi Amnon told the bishop that he needed 3 days to consider the matter. Rabbi Amnon, of course, was not even thinking of converting. but he hoped that after 3 days the bishop would forget his demand. And upon arriving home, though, Rabbi Amnon was distraught, for he realized that he had committed a terrible blunder. He had given the bishop the impression that he considered betraying his God. For 3 days Rabbi Amnon prayed and fasted to atone for his misleading words. At the end of the 3-day period, he was brought forcibly to the bishop. Rabbi Amnon said that his tongue should be cut out as a punishment for uttering words that could be construed as blasphemous. The bishop responded that the tongue was not at fault, however his feet would be cut off, for they had refused to come. After each limb was removed, the bishop asked Rabbi Amnon if he would agree to convert. Bleeding and in terrible pain, Rabbi Amnon steadfastly refused. The bishop then ordered his hands and arms to be cut off, again asking him to agree to become a Christian. Despite this horrific ordeal, Rabbi Amnon would not renounce his Judaism. Rabbi Amnon was sent home on a stretcher. A few days later, on Rosh Hashanah, he asked to be brought to the shul. Lying on the stretcher, he was placed near the chazan. When the chazan was about to begin reciting the holy Kedusha prayer, Rabbi Amnon motioned for him to stop. The shul was hushed as Rabbi Amnon, in a loud voice, recited the intense emotional prayer he had composed, inspired by his Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying of Hashem's name. In the face of the bishop's cruel tortures, his body, overcome by the wounds inflicted upon it, expired as he finished. His prayer in the Sanu Tokev is one of the most emotional parts of the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur Musaf. We move on now to Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile, and he is the one that prohibits polygamy. Rabbeinu Gershom, this is the same year, 4760, the undisputed leader of Ashkenazic Jewry, was known by the honored title Maor HaGola, Light of the Exile. He convened a gathering of rabbis in Germany at which a number of important regulations, takonos, were enacted as binding on all of Ashkenazic Jewry and their descendants. Anyone breaking these regulations would be harshly punished by excommunication, called Chayim Rabbeinu Gershom. The most famous regulation was the prohibition of polygamy, something which until this time had been permitted, though rarely practiced. Other takanas prohibited divorcing a wife against her will, reading other people's mail, or shaming Jews who had converted to Christianity under duress. Rabbeinu Gershom headed the yeshiva in Mainz, Germany. Because of his great stature and that of his students, who became the teachers of the famed Rashi, his yeshiva made Germany Ashkenaz, as it was called by the Jews, the preeminent Torah center of its day. Students came to his yeshiva from as far away as Italy, Spain, and Babylonia. The establishment of Rabbeinu Gershom's yeshiva created a new center of Torah study, in addition to those in Babylonia and elsewhere. Ultimately, Europe became the center of Jewish learning and creativity until the Holocaust wiped everything out. I don't know if you know it, but Rabbeinu Gershom's own son was forced to convert to Christianity. Upon his death, his father observed a double period of Shiva, one for his son's physical demise and one for his son's spiritual demise. We go on to the year 4787. I would rather just use the Hebrew year instead of using the English year. We now talk about Rabbi Shmuel Hanogid, who was appointed the Grand Vizier. Rabbi Shmuel was a student of Rabbi Chanoch, who had been one of the four captives. When Rabbi Shmuel's native city, Cordoba, Spain, was torn by civil war, its vibrant Jewish community was destroyed. Shmuel became a spice merchant in the port city of Malaga in the Berber kingdom of Granada. A brilliant student of Rabbi Chanoch on Talmud studies, he also received a thorough secular education and was proficient in mathematics, languages, poetry, and science. In Malaga, he composed letters for illiterate Gentiles, which they then presented to the ruler's top minister and advisor, the vizier Ibn al-Arif. The vizier, impressed by the contents and writing style, recognized Reb Shmuel's great talents and wisdom and appointed him his personal secretary. Rabbi Shmuel's new position required that he move to Granada, where the palace was located. The advisor gave King Khabus of Granada excellent advice. What the king didn't know was that much of that advice came from the Jew Rabbi Shmuel Hanogid. As a result of Shmuel's wisdom, the kingdom of Granada became powerful and prosperous. Before Ibn al-Arif died, he advised the king to appoint Rabbi Shmuel as the new visor of the kingdom. Rabbi Shmuel came to be called Shmuel Hanogid, or Shmuel the Prince. In this powerful and prestigious position, he used his influence, wealth, and power to help the Jews in many countries. In his own city, he established a yeshiva in which he personally delivered lectures. Adjoining the yeshiva was a large library containing sforim, books, holy books, written by hand. Rabbi Shmuel supported synagogues and yeshivas in the faraway lands of Babylonia, Sicilia, and the Eretz Israel. He also distributed charity to the poor in the city of Granada. When King Khabus died and his son Bedus inherited the throne, Rabbi Shmuel became even more powerful. Like Yosef in the Torah, he was master of the kingdom in every way but in title. King Bedus left all affairs of the state in the hands of Rabbi Shmuel. The king was too busy enjoying himself to be bothered with running his kingdom. Rabbi Shmuel was a diplomat, a statesman, commander-in-chief of the army, and a warrior who commanded soldiers in the battlefield. Despite all his responsibilities, he continued his pursuit of Torah knowledge. He authored halachic works and composed prayers in the form of Hebrew poetry, piyutim. He carried on extensive written debates with Rabbi Yonah ibn Zanach on issues of Hebrew grammar. It's told that once when Shmuel Hanogid was walking with the king, an Arab shopkeeper directed a long stream of curses against Rabbi Shmuel. The enraged king ordered Rabbi Shmuel to have the man's tongue cut out. Some weeks later, the king was walking with Rabbi Shmuel again when they encountered the same man. This time he greeted Rabbi Shmuel with blessings and words of praise. The king asked Rabbi Shmuel why he hadn't carried out the royal orders. Rabbi Shmuel's reply was that he had indeed fulfilled the king's decree. By sending the man gifts and talking with him, he had cut out the man's evil tongue and replaced it with a good one. Rabbi Shmuel's wisdom had turned an enemy into a lifetime friend. Now also, Shmuel HaNogid lived at the same time as the author of the great Musar classic Chovos HaLevavos, Duties of the Heart, written originally in Arabic by Rabbi Bechaya ben Yosef ibn Pekuda. If you are interested, by the way, in learning the Sefer Chovos HaLevavos, you can do so online at EnglishTorahTapes.com, where you can listen and download thousands of Torah Shiurim, all for free. Okay, now we go on to the year 4800, the birth of Rashi. What does Rashi say? This is one of the first questions a young child learning Chumash hears his Rebbe ask. It's often the first question a Torah scholar will ask when beginning to study a topic in the Gemara. Known as the teacher of the Jewish people, Rashi speaks to the young boy and to the greatest sages of the age, each on his own level. Rashi was born in Troyes, France, to a father who, through his extraordinary piety, merited such an exceptional son. Once Rabbi Yitzchok, the father, was traveling on a ship with a beautiful gem. As a businessman, he had invested heavily in the purchase of the stone and anticipated making a large profit through its sale. While on the ship, he was approached by Gentiles who wished to purchase the stone to adorn their temple, but he refused their offers. Thinking Rabbi Yitzchak was merely bargaining for a higher price, they offered larger and larger amounts of money. However, Rabbi Yitzchak did not want his diamond to beautify a house of idol worship. Recognizing that the potential buyers were determined to get the gem, even if it meant robbing it from him, he threw it into the ocean. Not long afterwards, in the same year that the great leader of Ashkenaz Jewry, Rabbeinu Gershom, which we spoke about before, of the Meir Gola, also known as the Meir Gola, passed away. Rabbi Yitzchak's son, Rashi, was born. His father called him Shlomo. Rashi's full name is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, son of Yitzchak. Represents the acronym formed by the first letters of his name, Rashi. At that time, the great Torah centers were in Worms and in Mainz. Rashi traveled from his birthplace, Troyes, to study in these cities. He returned to his hometown at the age of 25, an accomplished scholar, and he married there. Rashi spent the rest of his time as the leader of the yeshiva he founded in Troyes, France, learning, teaching, and writing his exhaustive commentaries, which explain almost every phrase in the five books of Torah, the books of the prophets, and the writings and the Talmud. Rashi's commentary is unique in its ability to explain even the most difficult text. Young students and great scholars study Rashi, as we mentioned before, and hundreds of books have been written to explain the deeper meaning of his simple comments. He was called the father of all commentators. Rashi's last years were marred by the tragedy of the murderous rampage of the first crusaders, who massacred the Jewish communities of Worms and Mainz. He had several daughters who were married to the best of his students. His grandsons became the great Talmud scholars, the Balei HaTosfos. Among them were Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam. Rashi passed away at the age of 65, but he lives on today in all generations through his teachings, which are studied wherever Torah is taught. To tell you an interesting story about Rashi, when Rashi's mother was pregnant and walking down a narrow alleyway in Troyes, France, a horseback rider almost trampled her. Miraculously, the wall behind her opened. She stepped back into the wall, and the horseman passed her by, leaving her unharmed. Until World War II, there was a place in the wall of the city which was known as the spot where the wall had opened for Rashi's mother. Another story told about Rashi was that one of the leaders of the First Crusade, Godfrey of Bouillon, the Duke of Lorraine, visited Rashi before setting out to capture Eretz Israel for the Christians with his army of thousands. Perhaps the Duke wanted to boast about his future winnings. Rashi told him that he would return to Troyes with only one escort. Angry and outraged at Rashi's impotence, the Duke told Rashi that should his forecast not be fulfilled to the letter, he would be put to death. The Duke's army won a great victory and slaughtered all the Jews and Muslims they found in Yerushalayim. Godfrey left his force in Eretz Israel, where they built forts and controlled the land for over 80 years. The Duke returned to Troyes escorted by two officers, not one, and looked forward to carrying out his promise to kill Rashi, since his prediction had not come true. However, as Godfrey entered the gates of the city, a massive stone fell from the arch and crushed the skull of one of his two men, killing him instantly. The Duke entered Troyes with one soldier at his side, just as Rashi had foretold. Now, until recently, did you know visitors to the city of Worms could see the shul where Rashi studied? It stood for 9 centuries. When it celebrated its 900th anniversary in the year 1934, Germany was already under Nazi rule. 4 years later, on Kristallnacht, the shul was set ablaze by the Nazis, and it was then reconstructed in 1961. And by the way, Rashi, besides being a tremendous Talmid Chacham, earned his living as a wine merchant, growing grapes and making wine. Now we move on to history, to the year 4848, and we're going to talk about Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez, known as the Rif. Rabbi Yitzchak was Rosh Yeshiva in the city of Fez, Morocco. He is called the Rif, acronym of the words Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez al Fasi. At the age of 75, slanderous lies were told about him to the government, and he was forced to flee to Spain. Though this was a difficult move for the Rif, Spanish Jewry benefited. Rabbi Yitzchak had a monumental impact upon them through both his writings and his students, most particularly the Rebbe Migash, who became the mentor of the Rambam's father. The Rif's students and their students after them became the preeminent leaders of Spanish Jewry. Nearly all of Rabbi Yitzchak's halachic opinions are accepted as binding by the great Sephardic halachic authorities such as the Rambam and Rabbi Yossi Kauro, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. The Rif wrote a sefer called Sefer Halachos, which is still studied earnestly in yeshivas today. and Beis Midrashim study halls over 900 years later. The Sefer Halachas of the Rif records the final decisions of the Gemara without the discussions that led up to them. Since he focused only on those issues and halachas that were practiced by Jews of his time, he omitted laws of the Beis HaMikdash and their cultural laws of Eretz Yisrael. In complete editions of the Talmud, the commentaries printed in the back of each tractate in Seder Moed, Noshim, and Ezekim, as well as in the tractates of Brachos and Chulin. Essentially, the Rif is a halachic distillation of the Talmud and is considered an integral part of advanced Talmud study. And by the way, I don't know if you know it, but the Rif was 27 years old when Rashi was born. Now just think about this for a moment. Rashi lived approximately 1,000 years ago, yet from the last 1,000 years, millions, not thousands, but millions of Jewish people study Rashi every single day. Can you imagine the impact that Rashi and the Rif and all of these people had on world Jewry? We go on to the year 4512. Completion of the first major Talmud dictionary. So in the city of Rome, we're going to talk about Rabbi Nosson ben Yechiel. He completed the Aruch, a dictionary of over 3,000 words found in the Talmud. The Aruch did not only translate, it also provided analysis of many subjects in the Talmud and was a major contribution to Talmud study. The author was the leader of the Jewish community in Rome and one of the famous scholars who studied in the great Torah centers that flourished in Italy during the 12th and 13th centuries. Bari and Otranto were Italian cities about which Jews said that from Bari the Torah was spread and the law of God from Otranto. Now it's interesting that the Aruch lived at the same time as Rashi and they wrote letters to each other, and in fact the Aruch was a very successful doctor. Now we're going to talk about the Tosfos. Rabbeinu Tam is mentioned by name often more than any other Tosfos. His name was Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, and he was called Tam because he was compared to our forefather Yaakov, whom the Torah describes as Ish Tam. His explanations, questions, and answers on the Talmud texts are evidence of his powerful mind and vast Torah knowledge. Rabbeinu Tam was a very wealthy man who employed many Jewish and non-Jewish servants. He had many halachic disagreements with his grandfather Rashi. One of the best known is in the order of the Torah passages that are placed in the Tefillin. All men wear tefillin with the psukim in the order dictated by Rashi. Some people, however, mostly Hasidim and Sephardic Jews, wear two pairs of tefillin during the morning prayers. They begin with the Rashi tefillin and then, towards the end of the prayers, remove those and put on a pair of Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin. By the way, there is a shir called Rishonim, also available under biographies of great Rabbanim, that you could learn more detailed about all the Rabbanim we're talking about. Next we come to Rav Shmuel ben Meir, another grandson of Rashi who was a Tosfos, wrote an important commentary on various tractates of the Talmud. His commentary on those portions of tractate Baba Basra where we do not have a commentary from Rashi appears in standard Talmud editions. He also wrote a commentary and the Chumash known by his acronym Rashbam. He explains the Pesukim using the simplest meaning of the text. His commentary in the last chapter of Tractate Pesachim is printed on the Talmud page directly under that of his grandfather. Another Tosfos was Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, was one of the first of the German Kabbalists called the Hasidei Ashkenaz. The Hasidei Ashkenaz led a life inspired by mysticism. Rabbi Yehuda fasted almost every day, eating only at nighttime. He wrote Sefer Hasidim, a guide to ethical behavior. A number of the directives that appear in his will which is known as the Zvos Rabbi Yehuda Chosid, had become widely accepted. The custom that a man does not marry a woman with the same name as his mother is due to Rabbi Yehuda Chosid's ruling. And then we have the Ri, Rabbi Yitzchok of Dan Meir, a nephew and student of Rabbi Natam and descendant of Rashi, is after his uncle the next most frequently mentioned Tosfos in the commentary. He had 60 students. Each one knew an entire Masechta of Talmud by heart. During the Shiurim in the Yeshiva, any one of these 60 would be called upon to analyze a point being discussed. In the year 4907, Rabbeinu Tam, which we just mentioned, one of the Tosfos, was attacked by the Crusaders on the second day of Shavuos. Crusaders burst into the house of Rabbeinu Tam. They rampaged through the home of the Holy Tzaddik, the most famous of the Tosfos, stole all his possessions, desecrated his Sefer Torah, and wounded him. Miraculously, he escaped with his life. We now come to the year 4925. We're going to talk about the Rambam now. The Rambam arrives in Egypt. In the Arab world, he was recognized as the best physician of his time. To the Jews, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, the Rambam, an acronym of the first letters of his name, known in English as Maimonides, was one of the greatest rabbis that ever. Once again, Maimonides, known as the Rambam, was one of the greatest rabbis that ever lived. On his gravestone in Tveria, Israel, it reads, "From Moshe Rabbeinu to Moshe ben Maimon, there was no one like Moshe." Now, the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvos, which lists all the Torah commandments, and his Sefer Morin Nevuchim, a guide to the perplexed, and commentary on the Mishnah, were all written in Arabic. The Hebrew versions that have been used for centuries are all translations. The Sefer HaMitzvahs, the Morin Nevuchim, and portions of the Mishnah commentary were translated by Rabbi Shmuel ibn Tibon, a contemporary of the Rambam. Though he never met the Rambam, they wrote to each other, and the Rambam advised them on how to do the translation. Now, the 13 statements of Ani Mamin, principles of faith, are based on those formulated by the Rambam in his introduction to Chelek, part of his commentary on the Mishnah. The Rambam wrote over 10 medical texts, including one on poison, one on asthma, and an alphabetical listing of drugs. Born in Spain, as a young boy, the Rambam and his family became exiles, fleeing from persecution. After more than 10 years of wandering within Spain, the family settled in Fez, Morocco, only to be forced to leave once again. Traveling to Eretz Yisrael by ship, a severe storm put them in danger of sinking, but miraculously they survived. The Rambam annually observed the day that his life was spared as a day of penance, rejoicing, feasting, and giving charity to the poor in gratitude to Hashem. The Rambam left Eretz Yisrael after a short visit to the holy sites there and arrived in Fustat, the old city of Cairo, Egypt. Within a few years of his arrival, the Rambam suffered loss after terrible loss. Two of his sons, his wife, and his father all passed away. The Rambam was very close to his youngest brother David, who was a merchant dealing in expensive gemstones and other luxury items. Very often David traveled by ship, buying goods in distant lands, hoping to sell his wares in other ports for a handsome profit. Unfortunately, on one of his trips, the boat he was on sank in the Indian Ocean. This tragedy marked a great change in the life of the Rambam. David had supported Rambam from the fortune he had amassed as a successful and prosperous merchant. While his brother was alive, the Rambam did not have to work for a living, and spent his time studying Torah. When his brother passed away, the Rambam became a practicing doctor in order to support himself. His fame spread, and he became a physician attending to the Sultan, his many wives, and his children. The Arabs said of the Rambam that he was such a good doctor that if the moon would be his patient, he would heal it off its spots. Because of his great Torah knowledge, the Rambam became the leader of Egyptian Jewry, given the special title as Nugget. And as Nugget, the Rambam was responsible for the physical and spiritual well-being of all Egyptian Jewry. Now let's talk about some of the books that the Rambam wrote. The Mishneh Torah, a summary of all the Torah laws. The Mishneh Torah is divided into 14 books, which is why it's called the Yad Chazaka, the strong hand. For the numerical value of the Hebrew word Yad is 14. The Mishneh Torah contains all the rulings discussed in the Talmud, including laws about building the Beis HaMikdash, the Korbanos, the offerings, and the Jewish kings. It took the Rambam 10 years to write. Over the centuries, it has been the most intensely studied of the Rambam's works and one of the most important Jewish books ever written. There are well over 300 sforim published to explain the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Then the Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishneh. The Rambam managed to complete this work even though he was suffering the hardships of being a refugee, writing parts of the book on ships and parts wandering from one strange land to another. Now we have the Sefer called Namor Nevuchim, A Guide to the Perplexed, a book of Jewish philosophy and commentary on the Torah, which he wrote at the end of his life. He did so to help Jews in his time who had questions about their faith. Then he wrote the Sefer HaMitzvahs, a description of all 613 commandments. This Sefer contains two lists. One, a list of the positive commandments, those that Hashem wants us to do. The other, a list of all He doesn't want us to do, the negative commandments. It also explains the rules that determine how the Rambam identified which are the 613 commandments. This book was written as an introduction to his Mishneh Torah. Then we also have the Igeres Teman. The Rambam wrote a lengthy letter to the Jews of Yemen, Teman, who were suffering cruel persecution. The letter strengthened their faith and inspired them to remain loyal to their religion. The Rambam's teachings had great influence on the traditions of the Yemenite Jewry. We come now to the year 4929. We're going to talk about Rabbi Binyamin ben Yoria of Toledo. He traveled extensively for 13 years. His trips took him from Spain to the ends of the known world. He may even have been the first European traveler to describe the Far East. Medieval travel was difficult. Roads were unpaved and not policed, and travelers risked attack by wild animals and roving bands of bandits. Nevertheless, on camelback, boat, and horseback, Binyamin managed to visit hundreds of places, including Italy, Greece, Persia, India, and Eretz Yisrael. His diary of his travels is a valuable historical resource. It describes the rabbis and the lay leadership of each community and details the Jews' living conditions and sources of income. He records facts, figures, interesting stories, and paints vivid pictures of the places he went to and the Jewish communities he visited. This same person, Rabbi Binyamin of Toledo, describes the Jewish people, a Jewish sect in India known as the Black Jews, who claimed that their community on the Indian continent was founded by exiles from the first Beis HaMikdash. They survived until the modern era, when about 800 of them made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. We're going to go through some Jewish commentators from the years 1100 to the years 1400. We're going to start with Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran. In most tractates, the Ran's commentary explains the Rif's decisions, which we spoke about earlier. It helps explain the Talmud's intent and is vital to understanding the law. He also wrote independent commentaries on many other tractates. The Ran's commentary on tractate Nedorim is published alongside the text of the Talmud and is the primary commentary on that tractate. Rabbeinu Nissim's halachic responsum are frequently cited in later works. The collection of his essays on Jewish thought, the Rosh Haran, is a seminal work that deeply influenced many thinkers, including Rabbi Dan Isaac Abarbanel. We're going to talk about the Or Zeruah. Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna's work, Or Zeruah, was a halachic guide popular among Ashkenazic Jewry. His student was the leading rabbi of Germany, Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg, known as the Maram, and we will talk about him very soon. But interesting observation is in the early 19th century, So the only known manuscript copy of the Or Zeruah was lost in a shipwreck. It was found by a non-Jewish fisherman off the coast of Holland. Recognizing the work as a Hebrew text, he brought the manuscript to a Jewish villager who passed it on to his rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Tzvi Hirsch Leran. The rabbi's brother, the noted scholar and philanthropist Rabbi Akiva Leran, had it published in the year 1862. Now, we come to the Rosh. Rabbi Osher ben Yechiel was born in Germany, where he studied under Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg. After Rabbi Meir died in prison, Rabbi Osher, his outstanding student, became the leader of German Jewry. Afraid that the authorities would put him in prison as they had done to his mentor, he fled the country of his birth, arriving in Barcelona, and made his way to the home of the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderis. They had corresponded with each other, and the Rashba greeted the Rosh with great honor due to a Talmud Chacham. The Rosh was appointed rabbi of the Spanish city Toledo, and when Rashba died, the Jews of Spain turned to the Rosh to be the new leader. In his commentary, Rabbi Usher recorded his halachic conclusions of the Talmud's discussions and commented on the discussions to explain how he arrived at his decisions. These decisions, which appear in virtually every standard edition of the Talmud since 1520, contains rulings that greatly influenced later halachic codes. The Rosh is used by Talmud scholars to analyze the Talmud as well. Rabbi Usher also wrote a Tosfos-style commentary called Tosfos HaRosh, a Mishnah commentary, an ethical work, Or HaChaim. By the way, if you want to learn Or HaChaim LeRosh, it's available online. It's one shiur. It's 1 hour shiur. An entire sefer is available online at EnglishTorahTapes.com. And a Torah commentary, his responses are frequently cited by later authorities. We now come to the Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who was born in Spain, was a great Torah scholar, Hebrew poet, and a master of Hebrew grammar. His commentary on all the books of the Torah, printed in the standard text of Tanakh, is known for its linguistic and grammatical analysis. In composing his commentary, the Ibn Ezra drew on the works of Rav Sadia Gaon and other commentators and grammarians whose commentaries had been written in Arabic. He is also the only surviving source of many of these comments. He also wrote some of the songs that Zmir sung at the Shabbos meals. Now, it's interesting that due to the poverty, the Ibn Ezra was forced to travel all over Europe. During his journeys, he traveled from Spain to Rome to France, where he met Rabbeinu Tam, the famous Tosfos, and even as far as England. The Ibn Ezra is famous. He wrote books on Hebrew grammar, astronomy, and mathematics. The Rambam, which we spoke about earlier, had such a high regard for the Ibn Ezra's Torah commentary that he instructed his son to study it. We now come to the Radak. As an orphan at age of 10, Rabbi David Kimchi was raised and educated by his older brother, Rabbi Moshe. Although his commentary was written on the entire Tanakh, we have only sections on Breishis, the Nevi'im, Psalms, Mishlei, and Divrei Yomim. His commentary, one of the most popular on the Torah, is required reading for any serious student. Radak also wrote Sefer Michlol on Hebrew grammar and Sefer Hashurashim, a Hebrew dictionary. These were popular not only with Jewish scholars but also among non-Jews who wanted to learn Hebrew. Now we're going to talk about the Ralbag. Rabbi Levi ben Gershon lived in Provence. He wrote philosophical works as well as a commentary on the Torah. Generally, his commentary presents the simple meaning of the text, its philosophical underpinnings, and practical lessons to be learned. Also, the Ralbag invented an instrument to measure the position of the stars and planets. It's called Yaakov's staff, and was used extensively by astronomers and navigators, including the early explorers of the New World. This invention and his book on astronomy were influential in laying the foundation for the development of modern astronomy. He also wrote books on mathematics. Astronomers named a crater on the moon in Ralbach's name, and the crater's name is called Rabbi Levi. Very interesting. All right, now we come to the Ramban. This is now 5023, or the English year 1263. The Ramban, known as Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, was called upon by King James I of Aragon, Spain, to debate a Jewish apostate, Pablo Cristiani, who would present Christian arguments against Judaism. The Ramban requested from the king that he be allowed to speak openly with complete freedom of speech without fear of being made to suffer for anything he said. The king granted the Ramban's request. The Ramban, one of the greatest Jewish scholars, defeated its opponent with convincing and logical arguments. It was apparent to all the spectators that the Ramban possessed a greater knowledge of the Torah, and he was acknowledged as the victor. After the debate, King James awarded the Ramban a prize of 300 gold coins. The Ramban wrote his first book, when he was only 15 years old. Though the Ramban had been granted safety after his debate with Pablo Cristiani, his victory upset the church authorities. He was forced to leave his Spanish homeland, where he had been born and had lived for 70 years. Though elderly, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman undertook the dangerous and treacherous journey over land and sea to Eretz Israel. During his lifetime in Spain, the Ramban had become one of the greatest rabbis there. Because of his superior knowledge in all branches of Torah, Talmud, Kabbalah, and Jewish law, he was acknowledged as Spain's premier halachic authority. The many Sforim books that he wrote are used as basic texts today when studying Torah. After Rashi, the Ramban's commentary on Chumash is the one most studied. And if you're interested in learning the Ramban on the Parshas, you could do so by going to EnglishTorahTapes.com, where you'll find the Ramban on the Parshas. There are 12 different commentaries on all Parshas online at EnglishTorahTapes.com. The Ramban wrote Navalei and the Talmud and a number of important philosophical works and halachic essays on topics such as mourning and family purity. His glosses to the Rambam Sefer Mitzvahs are considered indispensable for complete understanding of that work. Arriving in Eretz Yisrael, the Ramban visited Yerushalayim. In a letter to his family, he describes the holy city as a small town of about 2,000 people. On the Shabbos only, a minyan of Jews were found in the entire city. They met for prayer in the private house. The Ramban acquired a building to serve as a shul, and Torah scrolls were brought from the town of Shechem to establish a proper place of worship. The Ramban stayed in Yerushalayim for a very short time, from Elul until after Yom Kippur, but the shul he established was used by the Jews of Yerushalayim for centuries. Its site houses a shul that is still in use today. Through his efforts, the Yerushalayim Jewish community started to grow once again. The Ramban settled in Acre, which had a large Jewish community. It was there that he completed his commentary on Chumash. Chumash. Now we're going to talk about the Maram, known as Rabbi Meir. Now we go to the year 5046 or 1286. Rabbi Meir, the leading halachic authority of Germany, made his decision. Stories of horrifying massacres of Jews in German cities and the harsh rule of the German government provided the impetus. Moreinu HaRav Meir, literally our teacher Rav Meir, the Maram, decided to leave his city, Rothenburg, and the German lands forever. In those days, Jews were not allowed to leave Germany, so plans were made for Meir and his family to escape secretly. As they were on the road to freedom, a Jew had converted to Christianity, recognized the famous rabbi and informed his archbishop, who had the Maram arrested. By order of the German emperor, Rabbi Meir was imprisoned in the Ensheim fortress. The emperor realized that he had captured the most important rabbi in Germany. The Maram had written over 1,500 responses to questions of Jewish law sent to him from all over Germany and other lands. He had studied under the last of the French Tosfos and had himself written the Tosfos printed in Masechta Yoma. His decisions on Jewish law were binding throughout Germany, and he was the author of several special prayers. He was the teacher of the greatest halachic authorities of that generation. The emperor knew that he could extort large amounts of money from the Jews as ransom for the Maram's release. When the Maram learned of the emperor's evil plan, he sent a message from prison to the Jewish community that under no circumstances should they pay the ransom. What would prevent the emperor from imprisoning him again to get more money, or imprisoning other rabbis for ransom, he argued? If this money were paid, rabbis would live in constant fear of being imprisoned. As a result of his heroic decision, the Maram lived in prison for 7 years, until his death. Despite his imprisonment, he continued to answer questions and to teach. He communicated with the outside world through his student Rav Shimshon ben Tzadok, who visited him in jail. Even after the Maram's death, the frustrated emperor would not release his body to the Jewish community without a ransom. For 14 years, the Maram was not given a Jewish burial, until a man called Alexander ben Shlomo Wimpen, a Frankfurt Jew, paid the entire ransom from his personal fortune. Can you imagine that? 14 years after he died, still holding him as ransom, he requested in return that he be buried next to this great man. Both their graves were miraculously preserved when the Nazis vandalized the ancient cemetery. We're going to talk about more famous Jewish commentators from the years 1200 to 1400. We will now talk about the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderis, a student of the Ramban. Rabbi Yonah of Gerona wrote a Talmud commentary on 17 tractates that has become an integral part of serious Talmud study. The Rashba lived his entire life in Barcelona, Spain. In the second half of the 13th century, he became the communal leader of all Spanish Jewry. His great wisdom was recognized internationally, and he received questions from Jewish communities in many different countries. Over 3,000 of these questions and answers were published. Many of the answers were quoted by later halachic codes and are very important in establishing Jewish religious practices. His Torah Sabayis and Avodah Zakodesh are fundamental to students of Jewish law. Among his prominent students was Rab Yontif Tov Ibn Avzvili, the Ritva, who write Navalei in the Talmud, responsive in defense of the Rambam's guide to the perplexed. Now we're going to talk about the famous Balaturim, Rabbeinu Yaakov. When Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of the Rosh, wrote his halachic code, he classified all Jewish laws practiced since the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash into four sections called the four Turim, rows. His work is referred to as the Tur for short. Almost all books published on Jewish law since his time follow the four categories of the Tur. Rabbeinu Yaakov quotes great halachic authorities up to his day, both Ashkenazic and Sephardic, with explanation where needed, and gives the final ruling. His code and its decisions was the basic halachic authority for the Jews for over a century, and is still a basic reference work utilized by today's rabbis. His brief Torah commentary is famous for, among other things, its brilliant gematrias, numerical values, calculations of the numerical values of Torah words and phrases from which lessons are derived. In addition, he wrote a longer comprehensive Chumash commentary. Agav Urchev, anybody who would like to learn the Baal HaTurim, besides learning it inside the text of the Chumash, it is available either on CD or online at EnglishTorahTapes.com. Now we're going to talk about the Meiri. Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri of Perpignan in southern France wrote the Beis HaBechira, an extensive commentary on the entire Talmud. For many centuries, his work was unavailable, essentially lost to the Jewish community. In the 20th century, the only complete manuscript copy of this commentary was discovered in the Ducal Library in Parma, Italy, and it was published. Written in a straightforward style, it is a collection and summary of different interpretations of Talmud passages by many of the greatest early Talmudic authorities. Rabbi Menachem also wrote commentaries to Mishlei and Tehillim, Chibur HaTshuva on repentance, the Magen Avos, an exposition on many of the customs of the Jews of province. Now we're going to talk about Rabbeinu Bechayim, weaving together four different styles of interpreting the Chumash: the simple meaning, Medrash, philosophy, and Kabbalah. Rabbeinu Bechayim, Ben Asher's commentary, has been a very popular work for centuries. His Kad HaKemach is an encyclopedia on moral and ethical topics. Now we're going to talk about Rabbi Avadya Bartanura, who settles in Shlaim, and with his life is in the year 5248 or 1488. Born in Italy, Rabbi Avadya, who eventually became the Rav of an Italian city called Bartanura or Bartanura, left Italy in 1486 for Israel. Traveling at that time was a dangerous affair, requiring a voyage on the high seas, where pirates were a constant threat, and long journeys on camel caravans through the desert. After a very difficult and arduous two-year journey, which took him through Italy, Sicily, Rhodes, Greece, and Egypt, Avadya arrived in Eretz Yisrael. He made his way to Shalim, where he was appointed chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. There he completed his famous commentary on the Mishnah, which came to be known as the Rav, an acronym of Rabbeinu Bartanura. In straightforward language, he explains the Mishnayos. This commentary has appeared in almost every standard edition of the Mishnah since the commentary was written. Now we come to the year 1492, the year the Jews were expelled from Spain, and we're going to talk about the life of Rabbi Dun Isaac Abarbanel. A descendant of David HaMelech, King David, Rabbi Dun Isaac Abarbanel was the leader of the Spanish Jewry at the time of the expulsion from Spain. He wrote classic commentaries on the Torah, the Agada, the Sefer Pirkei Avos, as well as philosophical works. Among his writings were many defenses of Judaism against Christian scholars. Some of his works deal with the ultimate coming of the Mashiach, encouraging his fellow Jews not to lose hope in the face of persecution. He was recognized as an international diplomat and financial genius, and he negotiated treaties between European powers. In 1490, the year that the cruel and dreaded priest Torquemada became head of the Inquisition, Abarbanel was appointed the royal treasurer, helping to finance Ferdinand and Isabella's war against the Muslims. Though he offered the king and queen a bribe of 30,000 golden ducats to abolish the decree, he was unsuccessful in preventing the expulsion. The king and queen offered to exclude him and allow him to stay, but he turned them down and left Spain with his Jewish brethren. Arriving in Italy, he worked for the king of Naples, but when Naples was conquered by Charles of France in 1495, he was forced once again to flee, eventually settling in Venice. This is the end of part one of the biographies, short biographies of great Rabbanim. If you're interested in learning about different Rabbanim, you could visit us online at EnglishTorahTapes.com and go to a page called Biographies of Great Rabbanim, and you'll be able to learn in detail much more about many great Rabbanim. In this shiur, we have reviewed the short lives of 38 great Rabbanim. Again, we will continue in the 1500th century, B'li Neder, in our next shiur.